Chapter 75. Prince sat down and bade the lady sit. The gentleman remained standing. There was, indeed, but one more cover laid at the table. "Which of you will take it?" says he. "The head of our house," says Lady Castlewood, taking her son's hand and looking towards Colonel Esmond with a bow and a great tremor of the voice. "The Marquis of Esmond will have the honor of serving the king." "I shall have the honor of waiting on His Royal Highness," says Colonel Esmond, filling a cup of wine, and, as the fashion of that day was, he presented it to the king on his knee. "I drink to my hostess and her family," says the prince, with no very well-pleased air, but the cloud passed immediately off his face, and he talked to the ladies in a lively, rattling strain, quite undisturbed by poor Mr. Esmond's yellow countenance, that, I dare say, looked very glum. When the time came to take leave, Esmond marched homewards to his lodgings, and met Mr. Addison on the road that night, walking to a cottage he had at Fulham, the moon shining on his handsome serene face. "Hat cheer, brother?" says Addison, laughing. "I thought it was a footpad advancing in the dark, and behold, 'tis an old friend. We may shake hands, Colonel, in the dark. 'Tis better than fighting by daylight. Why should we quarrel, because I am a Whig and thou art a Tory? Turn thy steps and walk with me to Fulham, where there is a nightingale still singing in the garden, and a cool bottle in a cave I know of. You shall drink to the pretender if you like, and I will drink my liquor my own way. I have had enough of good liquor, no, never. There is no such word as enough as a stopper for good wine. Thou wilt not come? Come any day, come soon. You know I remember Simois and the Sigiatellus, and the Praelia mixed Amiro," he repeated, with ever so slight a touch of marum in his voice, and walked back a little way on the road with Esmond, bidding the other remember he was always his friend, and indebted to him for his aid in the Yampain poem. And very likely Mr. Undersecretary would have stepped in and taken t'other bottle at the Colonel's lodging, had the latter invited him, but Esmond's mood was none of the gayest, and he bade his friend an inhospitable good night at the door. "I have done the deed," thought he, sleepless, and looking out into the night. "He is here, and I have brought him. He and Beatrix are sleeping under the same roof now. Whom did I mean to serve in bringing him? Was it the prince? Was it Henry Esmond? Had I not best have joined the manly creed of Addison yonder, that scouts the old doctrine of right divine, that boldly declares that Parliament and people consecrate the sovereign, not bishops, nor genealogies, nor oils, nor coronations?" The eager gaze of the young prince, watching every movement of Beatrix, haunted Esmond and pursued him. The prince's figure appeared before him in his feverish dreams many times that night. He wished the deed undone for which he had labored so. He was not the first that has regretted his own act, or brought about his own undoing. Undoing? Should he write that word in his late years? No, on his knees before heaven, rather be thankful for what then he deemed his misfortune, and which hath caused the whole subsequent happiness of his life. Esmond's man, honest John Lockwood, had served his master and the family all his life, and the colonel knew that he could answer for John's fidelity as for his own. John returned with the horses from Rochester Bedhams the next morning, and the colonel gave him to understand that on going to Kensington, where he was free of the servants' hall, and indeed courting Miss Beatrix's maid, he was to ask no questions, and betray no surprise, but to vouch stoutly that the young gentleman he should see in a red coat there was my Lord Viscount Castlewood, and that his attendant in grey was Monsieur Baptiste the Frenchman. He was to tell his friends in the kitchen such stories as he remembered of my Lord Viscount's youth at Castlewood. What a wild boy he was! How he used to drill Jack and cane him, before ever he was a soldier! Everything, in fine, he knew respecting my Lord Viscount's early days. Jack's ideas of painting had not been much cultivated during his residence in Flanders with his master, and, before my young lord's return, he had been easily got to believe that the picture brought over from Paris, and now hanging in Lady Castlewood's drawing room, was a perfect likeness of her son, the young lord. And the domestics having all seen the picture many times, and catching but a momentary imperfect glimpse of the two strangers on the night of their arrival, never had a reason to doubt the fidelity of the portrait. And next day, when they saw the original of the piece habited exactly as he was represented in the painting, with the same periwig, ribbons, and uniform of the guard, quite naturally addressed the gentleman as My Lord Castlewood, My Lady Viscountess's son. The secretary of the night previous was now the Viscount. The Viscount wore the secretary's gray frock, and John Lockwood was instructed to hint to the world below stairs that my lord being a papist, and very devout in that religion, his attendant might be no other than his chaplain from Bruxelles. Hence, if he took his meals in my lord's company, there was little reason for surprise. Frank was further cautioned to speak English with a foreign accent, which task he performed indifferently well, and this caution was the more necessary, because the prince himself scarce spoke our language like a native of the island. And John Lockwood laughed with the folks below stairs at the manner in which my lord, after 5 years abroad, sometimes forgot his own tongue, and spoke it like a Frenchman. Warrant, says he, that, with the English beef and beer, his lordship will soon get back the proper use of his mouth. And, to do his new lordship justice, he took to beer and beef very kindly. The prince drank so much, and was so loud, and imprudent in his talk after his drink, that Esmond often trembled for him. His meals were served as much as possible in his own chamber, though frequently he made his appearance in Lady Castlewood's parlor and drawing room, calling Beatrix sister, and her ladyship other, or Adam before the servants. And, choosing to act entirely up to the part of brother and son, the prince sometimes saluted Mrs. Beatrix and Lady Castlewood with a freedom which his secretary did not like, and which, for his part, set Colonel Esmond tearing with rage. The guests had not been 3 days in the house, when poor Jack Lockwood came with a rueful countenance to his master, and said, My lord, that is the gentleman has been tampering with Mrs. Lucy, Jack's sweetheart, and given her guineas and a kiss. I fear that Colonel Esmond's mind was rather relieved than otherwise when he found that the ancillary beauty was the one whom the prince had selected. His royal tastes were known to lie that way, and continued so in after life. The heir of one of the greatest names, of the greatest kingdoms, and of the greatest misfortunes in Europe, was often content to lay the dignity of his birth and grief at the wooden shoes of a French chambermaid, and to repent afterwards, for he was very devout, in ashes taken from the dustpan. 'Tis for mortals such as these that nations suffer, that parties struggle, that warriors fight and bleed. A year afterwards gallant heads were falling, and Nithsdale in escape, and Derwentwater on the scaffold, whilst the heedless ingrate, for whom they risked and lost all, was tippling with his seraglio of mistresses in his petite mason of Chalet. Blushing to be forced to bear such an errand, Esmond had to go to the prince, and warn him that the girl whom his highness was bribing was John Lockwood's sweetheart, an honest resolute man, who had served in 6 campaigns, and feared nothing, and who knew that the person calling himself Lord Castlewood was not his young master. And the colonel besought the prince to consider what the effect of a single man's jealousy might be, and to think of other designs he had in hand, more important than the seduction of a waiting maid, and the humiliation of a brave man. 10 times, perhaps, in the course of as many days, Mr. Esmond had to warn the royal young adventurer of some imprudence or some freedom. He received these remonstrances very testily, save perhaps in this affair of poor Lockwood's, when he deigned to burst out a laughing, and said, What, the soubrette is peached to the Amaru, and Crispin is angry, and Crispin has served, and Crispin has been a corporal, has he? Tell him we will reward his valor with a pair of colors, and recompense his fidelity. Colonel Esmond ventured to utter some other words of entreaty, but the prince, stamping imperiously, cried out, "Asses, Millard! Je m'ennuie le prêche. I am not come to London to go to the sermon." And he complained afterwards to Castlewood that he petted John, Lenoir Colonel, Le Marquis Misanthrope, by which facetious names His Royal Highness was pleased to designate Colonel Esmond, fatigued him with his grand airs and virtuous homilies. The Bishop of Rochester, and other gentlemen engaged in the transaction which had brought the prince over, waited upon His Royal Highness, constantly asking for my Lord Castlewood on their arrival at Kensington, and being openly conducted to His Royal Highness in that character, who received them either in my lady's drawing room below, or above in his own apartment, and all implored him to quit the house as little as possible, and to wait there till the signal should be given for him to appear. The ladies entertained him at cards, over which amusement he spent many hours in each day and night. He passed many hours more in drinking, during which time he would rattle and talk very agreeably, and especially if the colonel was absent, whose presence always seemed to frighten him. And the poor Lenoir took that hint as a command accordingly, and seldom intruded his black face upon the convivial hours of this august young prisoner. Except for those few persons of whom the porter had the list, Lord Castlewood was denied to all friends of the house who waited on his lordship. The wound he had received had broke out again from his journey on horseback, so the world and the domestics were informed. And Dr. A, asterisk his physician, I shall not mention his name, but he was physician to the Queen of the Scots nation, and a man remarkable for his benevolence as well as his wit, gave orders that he should be kept perfectly quiet until the wound should heal. With this gentleman, who was one of the most active and influential of our party, and the others before spoken of, the whole secret lay, and it was kept with so much faithfulness, and the story we told so simple and natural, that there was no likelihood of a discovery except from the imprudence of the prince himself, and an adventurous levity that we had the greatest difficulty to control. As for Lady Castlewood, although she scarce spoke a word, 'twas easy to gather from her demeanor, and one or two hints she dropped, how deep her mortification was at finding the hero whom she had chosen to worship all her life, and whose restoration had formed almost the most sacred part of her prayers, no more than a man, and not a good one. She thought misfortune might have chastened him, but that instructress had rather rendered him callous than humble. His devotion, which was quite real, kept him from no sin he had a mind to. His talk showed good humor, gaiety, even wit enough, but there was a levity in his acts and words that he had brought from among those libertine devotees with whom he had been bred, and that shocked the simplicity and purity of the English lady, whose guest he was. Esmond spoke his mind to Beatrix pretty freely about the prince, getting her brother to put in a word of warning. Beatrix was entirely of their opinion. She thought he was very light and reckless. She could not even see the good looks Colonel Esmond had spoken of. The prince had bad teeth, and a decided squint. How could we say he did not squint? His eyes were fine, but there was certainly a cast in them. She rallied him at table with wonderful wit. She spoke of him invariably, as of a mere boy. She was more fond of Esmond than ever, praised him to her brother, praised him to the prince, when His Royal Highness was pleased to sneer at the colonel, and warmly espoused his cause and, if your majesty does not give him the garter his father had, when the Marquis of Esmond comes to your majesty's court, I will hang myself in my own garters, or will cry my eyes out. Athier than lose those, says the prince, he shall be made archbishop and colonel of the guard. It was Frank Castlewood who told me of this conversation over their supper. Asterisk there can be very little doubt that the doctor mentioned by my dear father was the famous Dr. Arbuthnot. R. E. W. Yes, cries she, with one of her laughs, I fancy I hear it now. 30 years afterwards I hear that delightful music. S. He shall be Archbishop of Esmond and Marquis of Canterbury. And what will your ladyship be? Says the prince, you have but to choose your place. I, says Beatrix, will be mother of the maids to the Queen of His Majesty King James III Viveleroy. And she made him a great curtsy, and drank a part of a glass of wine in his honor. The prince seized hold of the glass, and drank the last drop of it, Castlewood said, and my mother, looking very anxious, rose up and asked leave to retire. But that Trix is my mother's daughter, Harry, Frank continued. I don't know what a horrid fear I should have of her. I wish this business were over. You are older than I am, and wiser, and better, and I owe you everything, and would die for you before George I would. But I wish the end of this were come. Neither of us very likely passed a tranquil night. Horrible doubts and torments racked Esmond's soul. 'Twas a scheme of personal ambition, a daring stroke for a selfish end, he knew it. What cared he, in his heart, who was king? Were not his very sympathies and secret convictions on the other side, on the side of people, parliament, freedom? And here was he, engaged for a prince, that had scarce heard the word liberty, that priests and women, tyrants by nature, both made a tool of. The misanthrope was in no better humor, after hearing that story, and his grim face more black and yellow than ever. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.